In this video, I want to interrogate Anglo-American assumptions about individualism and meritocracy, which are supposedly fostered by the free market. I am going to imagine two groups, a minority special interest group and a much bigger majority group, which I will call the out-group. This is for the purpose of thinking through the problem. These two groups are hypothetical only and do not bear any relation to any real-world groups. If you find yourself imagining that these examples relate to real groups, then it is your own mind doing that, and you'd have to ask yourself why it is doing it. So let us begin. Imagine these 100 circles are the members of a year group in a boys' school. So each circle is a young man. Three of these boys belong to a special group. Let's call them Ben, Sam, and David. In all other respects, Ben, Sam, and David look and talk like their classmates, but they belong to a special group. Their parents all know each other, and so the key difference is in the messaging they receive at home. Ben, Sam, and David are each told by their parents that they are part of a special group and are better than their classmates. This is reinforced on the weekend when they go to meet boys and girls from other schools that are also part of this special group. Meanwhile, all the other members of the class are told at home and at school that they are individuals who will succeed or fail based on their individual merits. Ben, Sam, and David receive the same messaging at school, but in practice, their parents ensure that they are given special treatment by pressuring the headmaster. We might see how belonging to this special group might advantage these three boys from an early age. Let us consider sport. The best in the year group is Billy, then Victor. Ben and David are in the next group down, and Sam is only mediocre. However, it just so happens that David's uncle is the manager of the sports team, and so, just like that, Ben, Sam, and David are always picked for the team. Now, as they get older, we might see this effect multiply. Let's consider their grades. Top of the year is a boy called Jim, then John. Sam is quite bright, but he's not quite the brightest. And then David and Ben are lower down again. But then, when it comes to applying for places at law school, Jim and John both want to practice law, as do Sam and Ben. It just so happens that Ben's father is the head of the law faculty at an elite university. So when the applications go in, Jim and John are both rejected, while Sam and Ben secure places on the strength of Ben's father's recommendations. Jim and John both end up at a second-tier university. Meanwhile, Joe, David, and Graham all want to become journalists, but it just so happens that Sam's father is the editor of a major newspaper. So naturally, David gets a work placement at this paper, while Joe and Graham have to start at minor local papers. Fast forward 20 years, and the pecking order of the school leaderboard has changed around. Now, David is a nationally syndicated journalist who is very influential and read by all the right people, many of whom naturally belong to the special group. Sam is a powerful lawyer who is often called upon to help draft laws by those in power. Ben is now a leading human rights lawyer engaged in driving an agenda for change at a national level. Jim and John end up becoming working lawyers, but for average firms. Joe becomes the editor of a local newspaper. Graham, meanwhile, can't make it in journalism and went on to teach English at school level. Now, let us imagine that these results among people who belong to the special group are replicated at a national level, whereby something like 3% of the population becomes the top 3% of the population. Has this happened because A, these people are more talented and more intelligent, or B, because these people have superior in-group preference? Is this A, simply the marketplace at work? Or is it B, because these people have superior in-group preference? Now consider that in addition to these differences in outcome, Ben, Sam, and David leverage their positions to further the power of their special group. David uses his national platform to advocate for laws that will be of benefit to the special group. Ben and Sam use their respective positions to implement said laws. In fact, the extensive network of those people in the special group coordinate between politics, law, academia, and the media to ensure that those changes are in fact made. They also leverage their power to ensure that anyone in the out-group, who make up 97% of the population, people such as Jim, John, Joe, or Graham, would be professionally hurt and even censored from opposing such laws. Now, although deep down they disagree with these changes, Jim, John, Joe, and Graham find it difficult to mount any sort of counter-offensive. First and foremost, each of them believes that they are individuals living in a society of individuals. They believe that they have achieved their positions through merit, and they don't want to hurt those careers they've worked so hard to achieve. In any case, there's no such thing as a group. So what is it that binds Jim, John, Joe, and Graham? Absolutely nothing. Within their own framework, there is nothing that they can say binds them at all. It strikes me that in any scenario in which there is an ostensibly free market, but in which money can be levied, whether through the media, academia, legal channels, or directly through politics to influence government decisions, this situation will always massively favour a tightly organised special group at the expense of everyone else, both in theory and in practice. In fact, one might argue that this sort of situation produces an incentive for the special group slowly to transition the system from being a nominally free market to being more socialist and command and control in orientation by formalizing their superiority using inequitable rules, which is to say, by making themselves an actual ruling caste as opposed to people who, on the face of it, do well, albeit using an informal power network. Thus, the nominally free market state can be used as a kind of Trojan horse to transition into a more socialist state, especially if the political system relies on persuading large groups of people using the media, as democracy, of course, does. Now, this might appear to be little more than egalitarian whining on behalf of the majority group. For example, why shouldn't the special group rule if they play the game better than anyone else? A fair question. Until we recognise, that is, that the special group's vested interests are very damaging to the majority group and to the nation as a whole. This presents a significant problem because it is practically impossible for the majority to organise in the same tight-knit and coordinated way as the special group can. Egalitarianism actually works as a hindrance here, and the special group can prey on lingering internal class resentments to its advantage, thereby masking its own supremacy. The myths of individualism and meritocracy work to their advantage because it allows the aforementioned informal network to flourish until such a time comes as they may formally enshrine their power in law. Therefore, it is in the majority group's interest to recognise their own special group. Let's call it the upper class, or you can call it the ruling class, who might realistically compete with the currently dominant special group. This requires those in the lower classes of the majority to accept that there will be certain built-in inequities. Let's say hereditary land ownership or opportunities that are available only for those in the ruling class, and also to divest themselves of liberal notions such as individualism, fairness, or meritocracy. Only with a vested and powerful minority ruling class could the majority hope to oust the special group, which could only be done by building a rival network and practicing the same ruthless in-group preference and lawfare, including passing laws that are inherently unfair, as the special group does. As ever, let me know your thoughts in the comments, and please, for the purposes of this video, do not try to assign particular people or groups to the examples I have outlined here. I will delete any comments that do that. Keep the conversation unspecific and theoretical, and I think we'll have a better discussion. Thank you. Friends, Romans, countrymen, shh, come this way. Lend me your ears. Secrets of ancient rhetoric can now be yours for a trifling sum. The art of persuasive argument is all around us. In fact, we are surrounded by it. We live in a rhetorical age, but this is seldom taught and even more seldom explained. It is not for you to know, they said. The master of grammar knows how to write with clarity, precision, and correctness. The master of logic knows how to disarm his opponents with reason alone, and both can be powerful adversaries. But the master of rhetoric can outflank both, caring as he does little for their rules and even less for their defeated tears. The master of grammar asks, is this sentence correct? Is this sentence clear? The master of rhetoric wonders, does my speech have the power to sway the passions? Can my words move the crowd? Yes, it can. Yes, it can. The master of logic trains his mind to eliminate fallacies and formulate correct and well-defined arguments. The master of rhetoric knows that the reasoning mind can be flooded with emotions, that the flood can short-circuit logic and overwhelm his opponent, who will crumple. They will wonder why their well-written, well-reasoned arguments were so defenseless against the rhetor's apparent ability to bend reality to his will. Do the faces in the crowd not see through this dark magic? The master of rhetoric laughed at their wonder. He looked at the bemused, despairing face of the master of logic and spoke. Harness that wonder, my friend. It was your own beloved Socrates who said, the only true wisdom is in knowing that you know nothing. And wonder is the beginning of wisdom. He turned to the master of grammar. So lucid and correct your prose. But why does nobody listen to you? It was your own favourite, George Orwell, who wrote, perhaps a lunatic was simply a majority of one. Do not rail at the crowd for what is in their nature. Understand what they are, and they will listen to you. And with that, the master of rhetoric was gone. Find out what else he has to say by signing up to Foundations of Rhetoric. Fulfill your destiny and complete the trivium. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.